This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 45. Got a great show for you today. Just a reminder, get a lot of questions now as we enter the brewing season about how to get started with Beersmith. And one of the best ways to do that is go to beersmith.com/video, where I have videos on how to get started with Beersmith, including setting up your equipment, creating your first recipe, and how to scale recipes and do a number of other things. My second announcement for today is I've entered beta testing on our Lite Beersmith app. I know a lot of people have been asking for a mobile app compatible with Beersmith. The Lite app is going to include cloud access as well as a brew day timer, has a number of tools built in as well as reference material for brewing. It's going to be available for Android, iPhone, iPad, and Android tablets. And we're hoping to have that available in a little over a month if I can get it approved through the stores. And that's going to be followed a few months later by the full app, which will allow recipe editing and creation. So there's going to be a Lite app and then a full app. And now, without further ado, let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Randy Mosher. He's the author of Radical Brewing, Tasting Beer, and he's also working on a brand new book we're going to talk about near the end of the show. He has a website at radicalbrewing.com. Randy, it's great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, always great to be here, Brett. Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity.
So I understand you just got back from Brazil, is that right?
Yeah, I did a week down there in August. It was lovely.
And you were out touring breweries, is that right?
Well, I was down, I'm doing some beer flights for a bar in São Paulo called Melograno. And we were introducing the beer flights to the public and some journalists and things like that. There are a very few really good beer bars, and this is one of them. And so they're trying to figure out ways to give people not just some good beers, but a little bit of education also. So,
did you enjoy a little bit of homebrew while you're down there as well?
You know, this trip I didn't taste a lot of homebrew. No. Certainly, I've had it in the past, but this trip was more about commercial beer.
Well, can you tell us a little about more about the growing homebrew and microbrew community down there?
Yeah, Brazil's a lot of fun. I mean, it's a huge country. It's actually bigger than the continental United States.
Wow.
So it's really, really vast. And there's, I think, about 200 million people there. So there's a lot of people. And, of course, it's not all middle class, but there's a very large and growing middle class. And one of the things they're looking for is something interesting to drink. So they have had some very uninteresting industrial lagers for quite some time. But in the last 5 years or so, there's really been a lot of interest in making good beer. And just like in the U.S., the homebrewers are driving a lot of the innovation and the passion, and a lot of homebrewers who have labels for their beer and names for their homebreweries and big dreams about getting some money and getting a license and getting open and brewing. And a lot of them are doing it. So it's very exciting to see.
Now, like here in the United States, I've seen pretty strong growth from South America. A lot of interest, certainly from my business side and across South America. What do you think is driving the growing business down there?
Well, I think part of it is just, they've gotten through, they had some years of bad political trouble a few decades ago, and you've got a lot of younger people who are well-educated and are traveling some. Brazil, the economy is extremely strong, so people have a little bit of money in their pockets, and they're looking for all the things that we look for: some fun, some entertainment, some great flavors, some passions to pursue. And I don't see a lot of differences as far as that goes, as far as why people are interested in what's going on. It's just they're a little bit behind in some ways, but they're right up to speed in others. It's just a matter of quantity now and really getting that public turned on to great beer.
Well, when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that many of the breweries down there are starting to experiment with local flavors, culture, and cuisine. Can you talk for a minute about that?
Yeah, like all the Western Hemisphere, our beer tradition was pretty, their beer tradition, like beer tradition here, was sort of dominated by German lager brewing for a century or more. And again, as people have traveled, as people have gone both to Europe and now also to the U.S., tasting beers, and they're wanting something more, but they're also trying to figure out ways to make those beers uniquely Brazilian. And I've got a number of people that I've been working with and just sort of hammering at them on the ideas. Like, you guys ought to put some Brazilian ingredients. You ought to do some things that are, that no one else in the world would do, and really try and find your voice and find uniquely Brazilian ways to make beer and some interesting flavors. And you know, the people in the marketplace seem to be responding to that. So it's exciting to see.
So can you give us a few commercial examples of some beers that are starting to head in this direction?
Yeah, sure. There's my friend who owns a brewery called Cervejaria Colorado, wonderful guy named Marcelo, and I've been working with him for about 5 years now, I think, or close to it. And we've got he's got an India Pale Ale. He was one of the first two India Pale Ales in Brazil, mm-hmm. and he's using a sugar called we would say rapadura sugar, but they don't pronounce their R's in Brazil like ours. They're like H's. So it's rapadura sugar. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially the same as the Mexican sugars that we get that are hard sugars. And the process is you just squeeze the cane, boil the juice down, and when it gets thick enough, you can pour it into molds and it will settle. It will solidify into blocks. But it does have a different flavor than the Mexican piloncillo. It's a brighter, a little bit more grassy, herbal kind of flavor rather than the heavier molasses type flavor. So it's definitely a unique flavor. And it goes great in India Pale Ales. Most people in the U.S. tend to think of India Pale Ales as all malt beers. But there's a very long tradition of adjuncts in British brewing, and particularly in the mid to late 19th century of the use of unrefined sugars. I have a quote from an old English brewing book that says something to the effect that we love these unrefined cane sugars that we get from the Caribbean because they have this great luscious flavor. And of course that carries through into the finished beer. So they have a good, you know, there's good reasons to use those. They lighten the body a little bit and make them a little more drinkable.
So what kind of flavor do you get from something like this, the hapadura?
Well, it lightens the body up a little bit, and then you get this nice layer that sort of, it's sort of somewhere in between grassy and caramel, and I know those things don't really relate to one another very much, but it adds a little bit of an herbal character, and perhaps one more layer of flavor that you might think would be some weird kind of malt. If you didn't know that it was sugar, so it's not exactly molasses like, but it has a sort of a slightly tangy herbal sort of character to the beer. It's fairly subtle, which is, you know, all right to use. Marcelo's also brewing a beer from what they call castanha de Pará, which is actually what we would call a Brazil nut, and those are wild harvested nuts. The trees only grow in the wild forest. They can't be cultivated for some reason. And that was actually brought to him as a homebrewer by a homebrewer named Ricardo Rosa. And they decided to brew up the homebrew batch into a full-scale batch. And that's they used $1,000 worth of Brazil nuts in the beer. And they roasted the nuts.
How big was the batch?
15 barrels, I think.
Oh, okay. That's still quite a bit. Yeah.
That's a lot of Brazil nuts. And they toasted them, and the fumes from toasting Brazil nuts kind of just about chased everybody out of the brewery. But it's a dark brown ale, fairly rich and full flavored, not quite a porter, but definitely kind of heading in that direction.
What do you actually get from the Brazil nut? What drives that? What does it drive into the beer?
It's nutty. It's nutty, and it adds a certain really luscious richness to it, and a kind of a nutty, toasted, nutty kind of flavor to it. Quite lovely and really enjoyable. And he's making beer with he's got some orange blossom honey, and that's local to the region that he's in, and he's got some coffee that a friend of his grows in Minas Gerais state, which is not too far from his brewery also. And he's also doing a really, really interesting Imperial Stout, one of the first also in Brazil, and he's aging it he's got different versions of it, but one of the versions of it is actually aged in cachaça barrel or barrels that would have originally been intended for cachaça, which is the local sugarcane juice rum, and made of a wood called imburana that has a really, really nice woody, perfumey kind of aroma. The beer itself has a special extra dark black rapadura sugar in it. Wow. And really quite delicious and very, very, very rare beer and quite coveted in.
Well, you mentioned Brazil. Quite a few different approaches here. Let's walk through a few of them, maybe one at a time. Let's start with local honeys. I know, of course, the White House recently published their beer recipe, which included honey.
Yeah, it's fantastic. There's a hotel here. I think it's the Marriott that's brewing, has a beer brewed for them with the honey that they make in hives that are on the rooftops right in downtown.
Of course, honey can be a challenge to brew with at times.
At times it's expensive and you need to be careful about how you use it. Seems to work best in the secondary, really, as a flavoring ingredient. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're trying to brew a beer with large amounts of honey, you have the problem of not having enough free amino nitrogen and other yeast nutrients. So if you're brewing with more than about, I don't know, I would guess 30% of your fermentables or so as unrefined honey or as honey, rather than malt, you're short on ingredients. And the other thing is,
you need to start then looking at maybe adding mead type mead type nutrients to it.
Yeah,
to enhance the nitrogen and so on.
You need some nitrogen, and you also probably need the zinc and some of those other things. And then the other thing is that with any sugar where you or any beer you have a large amount of sugar, the yeast yeast is a little lazy, and it would rather eat sugar that's simple sugar rather than eat maltose. And if you give it the opportunity, it won't develop the enzymes that are needed to bring those maltose molecules through its membrane and break them up. So it's best, again, to add sugar a little bit later in the process. So
after you've sort of finished your primary fermentation, your first couple down, days anyways.
Clear off. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
Put that in then, and you get better results that way.
So you mentioned they're using local honeys down there. Is it a flowering honey? I know, obviously honey takes on the flavor of whatever the bees are working off of.
Marcelo's using the orange blossom honey. Now, it's very interesting right now. They're going through some difficulties with honey and the because they're having sort of an EU type of organization with the South American states. It's called Mercosul. Mm-hmm. And one of the rules right now is that no animal products are allowed in fermented beverages. And that's okay. That seems really normal, reasonable. It's like you wouldn't want to put hamburger in beer.
So is honey considered
an animal
product? Huh?
And it's just like caught in this law right now. They're trying to change it, but nothing moves fast in the bureaucracy in those types of countries. So Marcelo has to put the honey in at the end of fermentation, after fermentation, really, and then pasteurize the beer, or it's not allowed. So he's trying to deal with that.
Interesting.
I bought a bottle of honey at the market in Belém, which is up near the Amazon. And this honey has the most amazing smell I've ever smelled. I wish we had like scratch vision on
smell-o-vision,
smell-o-vision on this thing, because it smells, it's incredibly floral. And then you taste it and you get a bit of wintergreen in it. It's just a flavor I've never tasted in honey before. It's just jungle honey. I don't really know where exactly it came from or what the flowers would have been, but it was quite amazing. So we're thinking about doing maybe a special cask ale or two with some of our blonde ale at Five Rabbit, and priming the casks with this jungle honey.
And for those that aren't familiar, Five Rabbit is?
It's a brewery that I'm involved with here in Chicago. Yes. So I've gone all Latin. I mean, I've pretty much, it's been a lot of fun. We launched in May of last year, and we've been contract brewing up to now, but we're building a 30-barrel brewery in south side of Chicago near Midway Airport.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, so it's really, really a lot of fun. I have a partner from Mexico and a partner from Costa Rica.
And do you have a website there as well?
I do. It's fiverabbitbrewery.com.
The number five or
five, yeah.
Number five, okay. Fiverabbitbrewery.com.
Five Rabbit's an old Aztec name. He's one of the gods of excess. So appropriate, we thought for him.
You mentioned a whole bunch of other flavors. Let's talk about, is it manioc? Is that another?
Yeah, manioc. You know, manioc is the staple starch of Brazil. We would know it here in the U.S. as tapioca. It's the same plant.
Wow.
And it's a root that they grate and rinse the water out of it. It actually has some cyanide in it, so that needs to be prepared carefully. But it's easy to remove that stuff apparently. And pretty much every meal you have in Brazil has some manioc in it in some form, whether to sprinkle on top of the food or as little rolls, or they have a lot of different forms for it. But Marcelo's brewing a Pilsner beer, and the name of the beer is called Kawim. And Kawim is a native word for manioc. And Kawim is also the name of a non-governmental organization that helps native people with the many problems that they have trying to deal with the civilized world. And so it made sense to me to, why aren't you putting manioc in this beer since it's called manioc? And so that's just a little, that one's a little bit more of a novelty. It's very hard to notice the very much flavor from it.
So it doesn't add a lot of flavor then?
It doesn't, but it turns out that there's a lot of different kinds of manioc, and some of them, we were at the market and they had manioc that was puffed. It actually was like popcorn and it had a slightly nutty character to it. So he's thinking about what he can do with that in a beer. So that might be pretty interesting to deal with. It's just absolutely really, from our northern point of view, it's this incredible paradise of new flavors and things to work with. So, I'm always looking for new stuff, and it was just overwhelming, really quite amazing.
Wow. Well, I know local fruits are also popular, and we certainly brew a lot of fruit beers here. What are some of the ones that work best down there?
Well, there's a brewery called Amazon Beer that's located in Belém, and they were the folks that we went to see. And they got a very nice operation with a very nice brew pub and a small production facility in an industrial park. And they're making a number of different beers. The first one that they came out with was a fruit called Bacuri. And Bacuri has a really intense sort of a lychee fruit, like rose petal kind of fruitiness about it. Very ethereal. And they put it in a light lager, which I think is pretty appropriate because this fruit flavor is very delicate, and they just let some of that fruit in there. They have another beer that's a German Hefeweizen that they add a fruit called Teperaba to. And the Teperaba has it's a really just a very bright, it's sort of one of those tropical fruits that's somewhere in between oranges and pineapple, just a really bright, happy, fruity flavor. And then put that on top of a really nice Hefeweizen.
So that one comes through. I know a lot of fruit flavors don't come through well.
It is a problem sometimes. Yeah. So that's another one they're working with. There's a brewer, I think outside of Belo Horizonte, which is in north of São Paulo a little, who has made a beer with Jabuticaba, which is they sometimes call them Brazilian cherries, but they're like a size of a large cherry. They're really deep purple on the or deep red on the outside. They grow on the trunks of the trees directly. Mm-hmm. And they're more of a southern thing rather than an Amazon thing. So you see them around São Paulo and Rio and places like that. People put them in their yards and eat the fruit. But the fruit's actually white inside. And it has a really deep, doesn't really taste like cherry, but it's a really deep, rich, fruity flavor. So that's pretty nice. It's difficult to find those fruits in the U.S. We've got a Brazilian importer here that, so a few major markets, you might be able to find a Brazilian, importer that would have some of this stuff. We're actually starting at Five Rabbit to think about, trying to find some sources for fruit pulps and purees and things like that we can bring some of these fruits in, because there's a lot of people in the Amazon and elsewhere in those rainforest type situations that are thinking that fruit might be a really good way to encourage people to wild harvest. Brazil nuts has saved a lot of rainforest because they just can't be grown in cultivation. And so the only way to do it is to preserve the forest. And there's a lot of these fruits like that that do best when they're left to their own devices, and they actually form sort of grove-like associations out in the forest. And so there are academics and people involved with the natives to try and promote the use of some of these fruits and nuts and spices and things to, as a way of generating some commerce and generating some cash, but not in a way that's going to tear up the forest and sell off the trees and turn it all into rubble. So we're looking at getting involved with some projects like that to see if maybe we can have those people help source some of those ingredients for us and use beer as kind of a showcase use for some of these interesting fruits. So we're hoping that we find some things to work with there.
I think you mentioned acai and cashew fruits.
Acai. Yeah, acai. We would see it as acai, but it's acai. That comes from the fruit of a palm tree. And these, they're little purple berries. They look a little bit like blueberries, but kind of oblong, sort of maybe cross between a blueberry and a black olive. But they have a really rich, meaty, almost like coconut meat interior, and then a thin layer of extremely dark purple tannic skin, almost like grape skin, on the outside of them. And they're extremely nutritious. They have a lot of protein to them, and they're generally harvested and ground up into a pulp, and it sort of looks like purple chocolate when they serve it. So they grind this stuff up and fresh and whole, and drink this purple chocolatey liquid. This Amazon beer is actually making a stout with acai in it, and that's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting beer too. Yeah, and that's available around the U.S. There's another one called Kupuasu that's a relative of chocolate, and that is one of the darlings right now of people who are selling superfoods. The mm-hmm. acai berries are also, because they have a lot of antioxidants and very high vitamin C, I think, and if not in that fruit, then it's certainly in a lot of these fruits. So they're your best bet to find them at the moment would be to look at these, just look them up and look up some nutritional, see if there are people selling them as nutrition.
While we're on the topic, is it possible to find some of the Brazilian beers here in the United States?
Well, not right now, but soon. I think there's some beers imported by Eisenbahn, which is one of the larger, slightly more industrial craft breweries. But the beers from Cerro Vanguardia, Colorado, will be hitting the stores in the U.S. fairly soon. And I know he's importing the Castanha de Pará, Brazil nut beer, and the Imperial Stout with Black Rapadura, and his double IPA, which he calls Vishnu. Just a little bit of a jab at InBev, who makes Brahma in Brazil and who has over about 80% of the Brazilian market. So Marcelo has his fun when he can. So
very cool.
We've done the labels on all three of those. So we're looking to have those hit the shelves here sometime in the next 6 months, I think. So that'll be fun to have his beers available, and they're quite delicious. So,
well, you mentioned also pulling in some local spices. Can you talk for a moment about some of the spices they have?
Yeah, we had a couple. One of the really interesting ones was a spice called Priprioca, and it's nothing I had ever heard of before or had any familiarity with. It's essentially the root of a plant that looks a lot like lemongrass. So it's a tall, spiky grass plant with a little flower at the end on the top, and then these really gnarly, hairy kind of root balls. And those little roots have, think of it as like really, really, really weird ginger. And it has a really intense kind of a super dry spiciness that has sort of a little bit of some characteristics of white pepper, mm-hmm. but also of ginger, or if you know galangal, which is a different sort of a ginger relative that's used a lot in Thai and Vietnamese cooking, that's a bit more peppery. So it's a really pungent, peppery, sharp tasting kind of herb. And Amazon Beer is using that in a red ale. And those guys are actually making some noise about importing into the U.S. also, but they're not ready yet. I don't think that they would like to do it.
Let's see, any other spices you might want to talk about?
Well, the other really interesting spice, unfortunately, is illegal to use in the U.S. You can certainly buy it and play with it if you want. It's called, in Brazil, it's called kumaru, but in European parlance, we would call it tonka bean. It's available in France. I bought some in Paris when I was there last year. It's used in confectionaries and pastries in France, where it's legal. Germans have a limit on it. It contains a product called coumarin that is somewhat, I think it's liver toxic, but it's, you know, some potential harm, but that's in very, very low doses. And so I kind of worked out the numbers. And if you brewed, and even assuming that most of the coumarin got out of the bean and into the beer, you'd have to drink at least two beers a day to reach the German agreed on amount, micrograms per body weight kilogram. And so it's, I think, more or less safe to use in small quantities. But it's a really interesting perfumey aroma that's a little bit like sort of a cross, has aspects of vanilla, but more aspects of cherry pit that has, or bitter almond. So it's somewhere in that family in terms of those flavors. So very, very ethereal, interesting, perfumey. And of course, it is used pretty widely in perfumery, where it adds a really exotic kind of touch. So that's a pretty interesting spice. And that's a jungle plant. They're small, look like kind of flattened, long, little bean, dark brown, sort of purplish brown beans, but very, very wonderful flavor.
So, Randy, is there anywhere in the U.S. you might be able to find some of these ingredients? Is it something you could find maybe at a specialty store or something like that? I think,
you know, unless you're in a major market like New York or Chicago or perhaps South Florida, where you might be able to find a Brazilian import or a Brazilian market that would be able to get some of that stuff for you, I think your best bet is to get on the old internet and start trolling around and see what you can find. Mm-hmm. So, again, this is all pretty new to me too. So it was great to go to the market and touch the stuff. And for every one thing I tasted, there were about 100 things there that I never really got my hands on. So it was kind of really wonderful, but a little bit frustrating too. I could have spent all day going through everything and talking to people about what it was. So looking forward to getting back there and really digging in and also doing our project and seeing if we can work with the people who are trying to develop these resources in a helpful way for the forest and the people there.
So Randy, one of the big questions I had for you is, you know, you find some of these exotic flavors in the food or the spices and so on. How do you go about actually deciding which flavors to meld up with which beers or which styles, you know, because sounds like most of the beers you're working with are, you know, based on an existing style, but then you're sort of rolling in these ingredients to try and enhance the beer.
Well, I think it's like anything. You have to really think about what the flavors are of the fruits and how intense they are. So, or the spices or whatever, you know, certainly with lighter flavored spices, you want to look at lighter flavored beers. Wheat beers, wit beers is, of course, a great base for anything very delicate or light. Triple also, or Belgian blonde, anything along those lines that are pale in color and relatively low in hops. You think about the flavors that are in there, and my goal always with specialty ingredients in a beer is to try and lay a base so that when you actually put the specialty ingredient on top of the base, that the base beer is doing a lot of the heavy lifting. You know, if you're going to make a chocolate beer, for example, make it taste as much like chocolate as you can just with the malts. Mm-hmm. And so the same thing is true with fruits. Think about what kind of hops are you using. You know, you might want to, with a fruit beer, you might want to use a Nelson Sauvin or a Citra or one of those more Southern Hemisphere hops or one of the newer exotic hops that has certain fruit characteristics to it. There's actually some new ones from Europe too that have berry-like qualities. And so you want to stay out of the way of the flavor. That's just rule number one. But also, how can you augment, amplify, or echo the flavors in your specialty ingredients with the ingredients that you're that you're working with in your beer, the standard ingredients like hops and malt. And then, you know, also think about what would taste good in a dessert. Sometimes it's, you know, beer has so many dessert flavors. Think about caramel and nuts and chocolate and all of these toffee and all these sorts of flavors. So a lot of times it's helpful to think about, if I were making dessert with this fruit, what kind of dessert would I make? And then you think, oh, well, this would be pretty good as a bread pudding or whatever it is. And then you think, all right, well, how can I make bread pudding or pie or croissants or chocolate cake or whatever? How can I make those flavors out of beer ingredients? Right. So that gives you some, that sometimes just thinking in another context is helpful, because you may have a better skill set that way in terms of working with those fruits and things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, rolling this back to the United States, how would, how could you take some of the lessons you've learned down in Brazil maybe and apply them to brewing here?
Well, I think, you know, have fun and try and express that tropical spirit as best as you can. You certainly can get a lot of things that they really eat a lot of in Brazil, mango, pineapple. You may be able to get cashew juice. I don't know. That's the nut actually grows out the end of a really delicious fruit that tastes a little bit somewhere like mango and pineapple kind of flavor.
Brazil nuts,
of course, those are easily available. I know you can get tonka bean from stores, so that's widely available. You know, some of these more exotic, well, acai for sure you can get. Like I said, they're making a stout. It's a fairly dense, heavy kind of flavor. So you want a beer that's pretty rich, that can support that richness of that fruit. Just go from there.
Well, fantastic. You were kind enough to share a little bit of the manuscript for your new book that you're working on. I know I'm switching topics here for a minute, sure. But
no problem.
I was wondering if you could just talk for a minute or two about the book you got in the works. I know you've been working on it for quite a long time now.
I have, and you know, working on a book is really strange because it utterly dominates your life for weeks or months on end, and then it goes away.
Takes a lot of time.
And then at some unspecified moment, it flops back on your doorstep and it occupies you again. So it's this really weird off again, on again. But I started working on it a little bit over a year ago. It's going to be a nice hefty book. My goal was to create what I think is a great beginner homebrew book that has enough detail to easily get people into a couple, 3 years of homebrewing. It's not as technically detailed as John Palmer's book, mm-hmm. but what it offers instead is a lot more focus on flavor and on recipe formulation and on how to think about beer from a flavor standpoint and a recipe development standpoint. So there's a huge chapter on ingredients. I've got 70 different hops in there or more that are all categorized into different groups, not just by their country, but by their flavor affinities and characteristics. And each one of those groups is the hops are put into an order. So it'll be really easy for people to get new ideas, or, well, if you can't get Rewaka this day, you can look on the chart and see what's close to that. And of course, everybody that brews today, except people who are making Sots Pilsners, has trouble getting hops. It seems like Sots is about the only thing you can get, no matter where you are or when. So having those substitutions is good. I've got a malt flavor wheel in there, so you can look at all the different types of malts.
Yeah, you're a graphic artist, and
artist. So
the manuscript you showed me was rich with amazing graphics. Categorizing everything.
I just think that there are things that the brain grasps intuitively and easily when you look at a picture or a chart, where to read text, it's just much more difficult to draw those conclusions. And like the thing that struck me, and I kind of knew it existed, but once I drew the chart on malt, so I have a circle of malt that starts at zero and it ends at 500 in terms of color. And what you notice when you lay out all the different types of malts and just show, you know, this one goes from here to here and this one goes from here to here around the chart, is that there's a gap from 80 to about 150 or 200 where they don't make malt. Right. And so that what that means is, and the reason they don't make it is because it's god awful horrible in that range. It's really like ashtray like, right? So it has this like just ashy campfire, really, really harsh and unpleasant. And so that's good to know theoretically, but what that also tells you is that that malt that is the lightest one of the darker malts, that once it picks back up and they start selling malt again,
right,
that's chocolate malt. That's right. Light chocolate malt. And that malt has the most unfortunate name, because it really should be called really sharp diner coffee malt. People use a lot of chocolate malt because they think it tastes like chocolate, because the name is chocolate. And I mean, it's illogical to make that assumption.
Right.
But it really has, if you want chocolatey, you really need to go to black malt. So a lot of, I mean, I talk to people about their recipes, and a common question I get is, why is this beer so harsh? And they give me a brown ale or a porter or something. And, you know, it's like, is there chocolate malt in here? Oh yeah. I use like two pounds of chocolate malt in here, you know, cause I really like chocolate. Like, no. Chocolate malt's the most intense malt there is. And so you have to be really careful with it. So, but just having that graphical presentation of information, that's a really useful little fact for everybody. And so lots of things like that. I've got a spice wheel in it. I've got lots of graphical charts showing different, you know, really everything. If anybody out there is familiar with the old Brewer's Companion that was published many, many years ago, sure, by Charlie Finkel at Merchant Devan, this book picks up the spirit of that book without all the horrible typos and 20-year-old information now. I'm just trying to make the great new book for our age. I know people are really, really interested in recipes and in flavor and going beyond styles. This certainly has plenty of style information, and there's recipes for that, but it also, if you want to go off the style pathway, there's a whole chapter, and a big chapter on international beers. So there's a chapter that covers Argentina and Italy and of course Brazil and a lot of other places. So just to see what people are doing around the world.
As you mentioned, I mean, it's a pretty substantial book. It's not just a beginner, you know, here's how to make your first batch
type
book.
It's going to be 350 pages or so. It's going to be a big honking thing. So
nice big book.
Well, it's 133,000 words right now, if that means anything.
Wow. That's quite a few words. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So how far are you in the process now making the book?
Well, I've written it, and it's been back for one round of edit. It's been to the editor and back. Now it's back with them, but they're about done with it. They're about to send it back to me. It's had a technical review by a chemist, but not a brewer. So I've got it with a friend of mine up in Seattle who is both a biochemist and a brewer. So he's doing a quick review on it. Well, hopefully not so quick. And we're looking at getting it into publication by sometime early next year. So I don't know what that means. My publisher is a little vague on all.
So early next year, and the title's going to be?
At this point, it's called the Homebrewing Handybook.
And who's publishing it?
It is Chronicle Books in San Francisco.
Okay, Chronicle Books.
Yeah, the title actually is a bit of a nod to a really great old American brewing book called The Handybook. The Handybook of Brewing, which was published around 1910 or so by a company in Chicago that was a competitor of the Siebel Institute at the time. And it's just a beautiful, dense little book, just all full of great information. And I just thought that would be kind of a fun name for this.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting my hands on my copy. Hopefully you'll sign it for me, right, Randy?
Me too. Oh, yes, of course. I love signing books, you know. I love, you know, I love that people read still. So,
no, it's great. Yeah. Well, thank you, Randy. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's always great, Brad.
It's great to have you, and looking forward to your new book. And let's see, I want to plug a couple of your things here. Let me try and get through all of them here. Today, my guest was Randy Mosher. He's the author of Radical Brewing and Tasting Beer, both of which are excellent books. His website is at radicalbrewing.com. And I mentioned your brewery, and we should mention the location. It's in Chicago, right?
It's actually Bedford Park, but it's near Midway Airport on the south.
Okay,
side.
So near Midway Airport, and it's 5rabbitbrewery.com. Is that right?
Yes.
And also has a new book coming out in February. Well, I'd like to say thank you for Randy Mosher for doing that great interview. Just another reminder, If you'd like to get more, learn more about beer brewing, you can join our newsletter. We'll send you an article every single week on beer brewing. Just sign up for our newsletter in the sidebar at beersmith.com. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.